Content warning. Discussions of violence, torture and death that some people may find disturbing. Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is an original podcast created by Candle and Bell.
This episode is dedicated to Eleanor Rogerson.
This is episode 5, our Halloween special, The Wall's End Witches. I am also going to apologise in advance for the fact that you can hear our office dog Scout chowing down on a bone throughout various points of this episode. Yes, for anyone wondering, she did very much enjoy the bone. Unfortunately, that means that you can hear her at various points throughout, just gnawing away at it. So apologies about that before we begin the episode. Welcome back to the Newcastle Witches podcast and happy Halloween. This is a special episode for Halloween. Today we are joined by Sylvia, who runs the Haunted Palace blog with Alana.
Hi.
Hello. Alana and Sylvia have been blogging for how long now?
Since 2013. We both met at university in the last century. Makes it sound very, very old. And we just love history and weird macabre things. So we decided to write about it and share our interest on a blog. So we've been doing that since, almost 10 years now.
Yeah, and you have two books out now as well, don't you, called The Haunted Mirror, Volume 1 and 2. Can get them off of Amazon.
Imaginative titles. Haunted Mirror 1 and 2, yes.
I mean, that's intriguing.
I want to know what haunting is in the mirror now.
All of it.
That sounds really creepy.
Sylvia's very kindly brought one of the books in for us, and me and Maria just keep both staring at it and having a look at the artwork. So
the artwork's by local artists Chick and Stein and Eager Imagination, friends that I've known for a long time as well. So it was very kind of them to do the art.
So today we are going to be talking about The Wall's End Witches.
Fantastic. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to the podcast.
Thank you for coming.
I love what you've been doing with the Newcastle Witch Trials. I've been interested in that for so long. So this is completely different from the serious history that you've been talking about. It is a folk tale. And I first wrote about it in one of my first posts for Halloween back in 2013. And then I later went back to just to have a look and see if I could find any historical elements to the tale. For anyone who's not familiar with the Wall's End Witch's tale, I'd like to start by telling the story.
Yes, and just for anyone who doesn't know, Wall's End is a small town in the north of England. It used to be the site of a very impressive large Roman fort, which is where Wall's End came from. And since then, it's had quite a diverse history. The Picts have been there, the Vikings, Saxons, everyone's been there. So
yeah, and I think these days it's primarily known as a former industrial town because of shipbuilding, it's swan hunters and coal mines, but all those, most of those have gone now. So this is a story from a more enchanted past in Wall's End.
And more magical than the kind of industrial part of Wall's End.
I think it's kind of surprising that Wall's End has a tale like this. So
definitely, especially when you look at Wall's End today, this kind of spooky tale doesn't seem to quite fit.
No, I know. And I mean, I grew up in Wall's End, and one of the things that struck me was people would occasionally say, oh, yes, down at the Dean, that's where the witches were. But nobody could tell you anymore. It was just, was it real? Was it just a folk tale? But it's almost a lost tale of Wall's End.
Oh,
so
I'm very intrigued.
Right. Well, are you sitting comfortably?
Give me a moment. I will whack my knee off the table, so I'm just shuffling.
So, The Wall's End Witches. Upon a time, one of the lords of Seaton Delaville was returning home from Newcastle after nightfall, and his way lying near the old chapel, now in ruins on an eminence near Wall's End, he was surprised to observe the interior of the edifice brilliantly lighted. Riding forward with the undaunted recklessness which in those days characterised many of the border families, he left his horse in charge of his servant at the gate of the burying ground which surrounded the chapel, and proceeded forward to gratify his curiosity. Upon a table, at each corner of which was placed an inverted human skull containing some inflammable substance that burned brightly, lay the body of a female, uncoffined and partly unrolled from the winding cloth. Around it, occupied in the preparation of charms, sat a number of withered hags, one of whom was at that instant employed with a short knife in cutting the left breast from the corpse. The uncouth visages of those who formed the company, considering the purpose for which they were assembled, might well have appalled a stout heart, and we cannot say that when Delaval looked upon them, his blood circulated through his veins with its wonted regularity. He stood, however, still for a time, and could observe the thin grey beards of several of the party as they turned occasionally their sunken eyes to the skulls which were flaming before them. He also perceived that when the beldam who operated as dissector had severed from the body the left breast already mentioned, it was delivered to an attendant who removed it beyond the range of his view in the direction of the belfry. Delaval now applied his strength to the door at which he stood, burst it open, and entered into the sudden dismay and consternation of the assembly, each of whom endeavoured to provide for their safety by flight. He rushed upon her, in whose hand the knife still gleamed, wrenched it from her, and his attempt to secure her, in defiance of her curses, was at last successful. Some of the company escaped by the way through which that he entered. Others ascended to the roof and took their departure through the openings in the belfry. These spaces also served to convey away the smoke from a fire which the workers of iniquity had kindled on the floor, and above it a cauldron or kettle was suspended from a beam by the rope with which the sexton usually rang the bell. The fire was fed with broken pieces of coffins, the breast which was cut from the body of the female, with other filthy ingredients, were boiling in the kettle over which fat and froth descended with a fizzing noise, sometimes allaying and again invigorating the flame. When Delaval had witnessed all the unhallowed objects, he hastened off with his captive and bound her on horseback behind his servant. He kept her securely until she was tried for the crime, and whether this was accomplished by virtue of his own authority or that of a jury, we cannot now decide. She was, however, sentenced to be burnt on the seashore in the vicinity of Seaton Delaval. When the order was about to be carried into execution, she requested to have the use of two new wooden dishes, which were forthwith procured from a neighbouring village. The wood and combustibles were heaped on the sands, the culprit was placed thereon, the dishes were given to her, and fire was applied to the pile. As the smoke arose in dense columns around her, she placed a foot in each of the utensils, muttered a spell, and cleared herself from the fastenings at the stake, and soared away on the sea breeze like an eagle escaped from the hands of its captors. When she arose to a considerable height, one of the dishes which supported her lost its efficacy from having been, by the young person who procured them, dipped unthinkingly amongst water, and after making several gyrations, the deluded follower of Satan fell to the ground. Without affording her another chance of escape, the beholders conveyed her back to the pile, and she perished amidst its flames. And that is the tale of the Wall's End Witch.
I mean, I have never in my life wished that I filmed these podcasts more than watching Maria's face as that story is told. I can see you giggling as well, Sophia.
My favourite part is the plates. I just love the plates going off and
gyrating and falling out of the sky.
Who decided that she would be using plates to escape a fire?
It's a great idea. I mean, and you wouldn't think it was odd, would you? You're about to execute someone and they ask for some crockery.
Yeah.
It's fine.
That's what I would do.
Nothing
what is your
here.
Last request?
Plates.
I want plates.
Plates, please. It's great. It's completely logical.
There is so much to unpack in that story.
I know. So, well, that particular version, it's from the local historian's table book by M.A. Richardson. So it's published around 1847.
Mm-hmm.
There's another version that's available online in the Monthly Chronicle of North Country Lore and Legend. And that's from April 1888. The later version is pretty much the same, but it omits a few of like the Gothic elements that Richardson has, Richardson does emphasise that breast quite a lot. The later version less so. And the later version also has a really stereotypical description of a witch, somebody with a stubbly beard, ugly buck teeth, red fiery eyes and withered, wrinkled skin. So it's all very much a storybook witch based on that. So I was curious. I thought, well, that both of those are 19th century books collecting local lore. So it's obviously a tale that's been around for a while. Richardson didn't really give a specific source for his story. He just claimed that it had been told in many ways before he wrote it down. And the Monthly Chronicle cited the most famous fan of that story, the person who told it the most, was Sir Francis Blake Delaval. And he lived between 1727 and 1771. And even in his day, both sources are agreeing. It's an older tale. It's an oral folk tradition. So it's been around early in the 18th century. So the Delavals are a really fascinating family. They lived at Seton Delaval Hall in Northumberland by the coast. And they kind of tended to attract really tall tales. There were lots of eccentrics. There's lots of ghost stories associated with the hall. Sir Francis Blake Delaval was a really keen gambler and not always successful, but he did accept a wager that he wouldn't be able to build a castle in a day. And quite amazingly, he did win that bet. And you can still see that castle. It's Starlight Castle. It's ruined. The ruins are in Holywell Dean.
All right, okay.
I've been there. It's really atmospheric. It's a little bit hard to find, and there's mainly just an archway left. I mean, the chances are he cheated slightly, that he already was preparing to build something so that the building blocks were there. But it's still a great story that, you know, this is the kind of people the Delavals were.
Yeah. If anyone is curious about the Delaval family, you can actually go to Seton Delaval Hall.
National Trust, I think.
Yeah, it's a National Trust site, and you can go into the building. It's massive. And of course, like, there are so many tales about this family.
Oh, yes.
Who just used to get up to all sorts and prank people be very cheeky.
Yeah.
Before
there was YouTube pranksters, there was a Delaval family. So
pretty much, yeah. They were like the Jackass, you know, TV series of their time. Oh, like, definitely. Genuinely, like, they used to pull some pretty amazing pranks on people and tell a lot of tall tales.
Oh, yeah. So, and I think...
See, I was just going to say, was he saying that it was him who caught the witch in the story, or was he passing the story on?
He was, I think he's embellished it quite a lot.
Yeah.
And one of the things with Sir Francis was that he was also a member of Samuel Foote's theatrical troupe. Samuel Foote was a fabulous 18th century comedian and managing, directed like theatre productions. He also only had one leg, so being called Foote was quite ironic. He was, so Sir Francis was a comedian and he was really theatrical, and I can just imagine him making up this, you know, he's got this story, maybe he's heard it growing up, and he's telling this story to his theatrical friends, his kind of upper class friends, and he's embellishing it, I think, and I think he's sort of inserted his relative in it, and added, made it very gothic and put local, you know, some local landmarks in, like Seton Delaval.
I can just imagine someone going, that's not true, and he's like, yeah, it happened to my uncle.
Kids do that in primary school. I can remember, like, people telling me stories when I was about 8 years old and being like, who do you know that did that? And they go, my uncle doesn't live here anymore.
Yeah, he's definitely a friend of a friend.
Uncle, he doesn't live here. He moved away now. Like, you can't talk to him. You can't ask him about this story.
Just early urban legends, definitely.
Yeah.
So he's definitely helping to make that story popular. And I think that's because of him. It's probably ended up in the table books in the Victorian period, because they're...
Well, they are such a high-profile family, aren't they, that if they were telling the story...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I decided to have a look for the historical witch in Wallsend, naturally the first place I looked was Jo Bath's books.
Of course.
Of course, because she's the go-to expert for the Northeast witches. And that's when I first got the name of Janet Pearson. She added her... I can't remember which one of her books it was. I think it was Charmers, an enchanter's book. And Janet Pearson was a Wallsend woman accused of witchcraft, and the case is covered in the ecclesiastical court at Durham. And there's a copy of those depositions and proceedings in the Littenfell in Newcastle. So I went along and had a look
at the actual court case, the case as it was, and they were printed in the mid-19th century, but they did reproduce the 16th century vernacular, which I am just not even going to try because I just, you know, I looked at it and I thought, no, I'm going to just paraphrase all of that. So to give you the summary of the case of Janet Pearson, the case was heard about in 1570 in the ecclesiastical courts of Durham. The accusers were a 72-year-old farmer called Robert Durham of Wallsend, a 20-year-old woman called Catherine Fenwick, and the vicar of Benton. And Benton's a village very close to Wallsend, so maybe a mile or two away. So Robert accused Janet of being guilty of using witchcraft by using the measuring of belts to preserve folks from the fairy. So I will go into what that is a little bit later.
Right.
Because it's strange. It's not something people have commonly heard of today.
No.
So Catherine accused Janet of taking payment for using magical charms to cure a little boy by the name of Benjamin Widdrington. And one of the allegations described the kind of cure she was offering to people. So she was asked to cure a boy who was taken by the fairy, and she instructed the mother to send two people to collect some south running water. They had to remain silent when they did it. Then they had to wash the child in the water, dip his shirt in it, then hang the shirt on a hedge overnight. And the theory was that if the shirt was gone in the morning, then the boy would be cured. The accusers sort of ended their little testimony by saying, and the shirt was still there. So it didn't work. And that makes you wonder if it's somebody who's not happy. They've paid for a cure and it hasn't worked. So they're just, making a complaint about it.
Which is something we've discussed in past episodes. It was in Tabitha Stanmore's episode. Yeah. It's like sometimes what happened when the charms didn't work.
Yeah. So they're happy enough if they work, but then they paid their sixpence and they want, if there's no results, who do they complain to?
Yeah.
And the final allegation was from Robert Thompson, the vicar of Benton, and he really just reported hearsay that he'd heard that Janet was taking payments from numerous people for healing those that were taken by the fairy. So I know Tabitha probably covered the magical world and fairy lore in that episode, but it's just that at that time, many people did strongly believe that fairies could harm you in your daily life and that a person could be blighted by the fairies. And if they were, then they would most likely visit a cunning man or woman for a cure. And one of the treatments was measuring, and the afflicted person would be measured with a belt. And if there was a difference in the length of the belt when they were measured the second time, that could indicate there was like a fairy presence. And then the cunning person would sort of try and sell them some charms or talismans to banish the fairies and cure them of their ailment.
I have a question.
Okay.
When you say measuring them with their belt, would they be smaller? Would they be bigger? Like, was it just...
Well, the descriptions, I think it's just if there was a difference. I'm going to make the stab at if it's less than, your fairy's gone. If it's more than, then you've still got a fairy on board.
Is the fairy just like attached to
that's
their
what
back?
Happens to me like every Christmas.
Yeah, you see, it's fairies. Always been the fairies, fairy light.
Not the chocolate.
Yeah, it's a bit like possession, I think, where they're like sort of the fairies somehow in you somehow.
Yeah. Diane Perkis has done some work on kind of fairy lore and kind of fairies and witchcraft and how fairy lore kind of changed into what then became kind of witchcraft belief. So there is a massive crossover. I've heard of the measuring, but I'd never looked into it. I was just like, that sounds odd. I'll look at that later and never did. Now I know.
This is what it is.
I agree with you, though. Christmas, there's a lot of fairies about. Based on all of that, all of those list of accusations against Janet, a lot of what she's doing seems to be quite in line with what cunning folk
practice. Very like normal.
Yeah, nice stuff. It's helpful. None of the allegations are like saying, oh, you've killed a cow or you've soured the milk.
Unlike some of the other stories in the kind of court cases we've heard where someone has died or something along those lines.
It's all sort of helpful. I think the main objection is that what she was doing was seen as immoral, that it wasn't, you know, in line with what the church wanted her to do. But in the 16th century when the case occurred, there were some attempts to suppress cunning folk, especially in the later 16th century. But most of the time, if they weren't causing any trouble, they could just fly under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes you wonder, why did Janet's practices suddenly pulled up to the fore? Why was her harmless and helpful actions appearing in a court case? And there's a couple of reasons for that, because alongside the allegations against Janet, her husband and son were charged with stealing a horse from the vicar, who also was one of the accusers. And the horse later turned up. But as well as that, and perhaps more importantly, in the footnote of the depositions, the printed copy, it notes that the witchcraft allegation against Janet is part of a series of exceptions against the witnesses in a tithe suite relative to the living of Benton. So tithe suites were really common at the time, and it's to do with payment of church dues.
Ah.
So the allegation, the tithe suite case was connected to the mother of one of the other accusers. So it was, I think it was Catherine Fenwick. Her mother, Constance Fenwick, was the mother of one of the accusers who said that Janet was a witch, and she was highly involved in this tithe dispute. So there's an undercurrent, there's like the family.
So they were already in court fighting for something else,
and all these other things come up.
This is, obviously we don't know a lot about Matthew Bulmer, but it's reminding me a bit of his, because he cropped up a couple of times in the court sessions for various different things, so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's, they've had this dispute about payment of church dues, and it's all connected with Benton. So you've got the vicar of Benton always, he's lost a horse, but the horse turned up again, and then he's probably aware of what Janet's doing, and then he's decided, oh, I'll just mention that here, because it shows this family's quite disruptive, they're not paying their church dues, they're stealing horses, they're doing all this, you know, cunning magic, like folk magic. So I think all of that's tied in, and I think it's probably a case of the family being well known in the area, you know, clearly lots of people had gone to Janet to get cures.
Yeah.
And it's only because of this bigger picture that that's come up as a problem.
Yeah.
And does she go to jail, or is she hung, or is she actually burnt?
Nobody knows, which is the sad mystery of it. It's not recorded in the copy of the depositions and the exceptions. It's unlikely she would be burnt at the stake. That was more like across the border in Scotland. Yeah. That was likely to be an outcome. I wouldn't have thought she would have been hanged. I mean, it was an ecclesiastical court that tried if they took it to that far, they might more likely to have just given her a penance. She might have gone to prison at a push.
What's an ecclesiastical court?
They deal with more canon law.
A church court.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and it did change quite a bit in the 16th century, because I think that the secular law was trying to pull back a lot of the powers of the canon law, right. and make it more of a secular legal system. But ecclesiastical courts still did look at sort of witchcraft and cunning folk.
Right,
but
okay.
Often they had less severe penalties, I think. I know that a lot of it was penance if it was something that you were just being a bit disruptive.
Yeah.
So I don't think she would have been executed or hanged, and certainly not burnt at the stake.
Except in the legend.
In the legend, yes. Yeah. So I think as well, going back to the legend, in the court case, there's the use of running water against the fairy. And that is an element that crops up in the folktale, because running water is what's used to break the witch's spell on the flying plates. So... it's definitely like a common kind of fairy lore in the area that it would have been known running water would be able to break a spell.
Yeah.
So I think that's one element that does come from that. But I do think that probably what happened with this is that this was a real person. This was a real case. People would have known about the story. And then in the following years, perhaps the memory of that story faded. There were a number of like really prominent witch trials. So... you have 1590, the North Berwick witches, north of the border. So you've got about 60 people being accused of using witchcraft to try and kill the king, James VI of Scotland.
Yeah.
And he was sailing back with his new wife, Anne of Denmark, and his boat hit a storm. And it was really, you know, considered to be witchcraft trying to kill the king. And one of the accused women in that set of trials, Agnes Sampson, was tortured into confessing that she'd sailed out to sea on a sieve, tied parts of a dead man to a cat that she then cast into the sea in order to sink the ship. So there's a bit of a similarity here with the Wolves End, which is in that it's like utensils being used as transport. Yeah. So, you know, that plate sieves.
It's reminding me of Hocus Pocus. Do you know, like, how one of them's riding on a hoover? And the new Hocus Pocus is coming out, and one of them's riding, like, two Roombas.
I was going to say, it's going to have to be that next.
I mean, so in, like, 500 years' time, there'll be a story of a witch that escaped on a Roomba.
Probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not?
Yeah. It's really fascinating to see, like, how an actual... You know, like you say, like a real person that actually lived and existed in this community. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe for our like innate desire to sensationalize or to tell a good story,
yeah,
we've people have embellished it and sort of removed the humane or the humanity like element from it. And it's like now this figure,
yes,
that could fly and was burnt at the stake. They're clearly like borrowing things from other witch trials, like, because they're in Northumberland, so they're closer to Scotland.
Yeah.
And just, like, embellishing this tale to make it really sensationalised.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that they've also got the Newcastle witch trials in the 1649-1650.
Yeah.
So that's really close to home. That's, like, 5 miles away from Wallsend. So this idea of witches and witch trials and fear of witchcraft, it's got to be seeping in the culture. It's there. Everybody's aware of it.
And what year was this going on with Janet again?
1570 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
So you've got that whole period where there's a lot of active, like, sort of seeking witches. Mm-hmm. You've got King James, who became James the First of England, writing demonology and being very anti-witchcraft and, you know, encouraging people to seek out witches.
Yeah, he was very obsessed with witches, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So Janet's case would have came before?
Yes.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, and just, I mean, sort of 1517, they've got 1590 for the Northern witches. And James, James the Sixth of Scotland, interrogated some of the witches personally. So yeah. I wonder if that's also an element of Delaval putting his ancestor in front and centre instead of the king being the one involved in the witchcraft.
Yeah.
You know, resolving witchcraft. But so that's the, the historical element. There's different things happening in the real world that could have been added into that tale. And I do think that you've got that real witch, as you say, she's engaging in magical practices. Later witch trials have been added in, and I think it's in no way provable, but I do think Janet's probably at some way the seed of the tale, that there's a memory of a real witch case in the local area, and that you get people like Francis Blake Delaval, who's just adding his own twist, embellishing it all, making it into a big gothic story for his friends, and then it ends up in a table book, and now it's almost forgotten. You know, in the 20th century, like I say, when I was growing up, it was a few people had heard of the Wallsend witch or witches, but didn't really know anything more than that.
Yeah. I mean, my family on my mother's side's from Wallsend. And when I said to them, have you heard of this tale? They were like, what on earth are you going on about? And I was like, no, it's a thing. I didn't just make it up. Yeah, it's basically been forgotten about. But the fact that it lived for kind of so long.
It evolved.
Yeah.
And I think now, like, when you Google it, there's a few people writing about it and there's a few vloggers telling the story. So this hope it might last into the digital age. I think it's fascinating. And Wallsend is not somewhere you associate with witches and folk tales and, you know, dark doings in creepy old ruins. Mm-hmm. And so I like it from that for that perspective, but also that some of the places you can go and visit. So Holy Cross Church is still open to the public. It's a ruin, and you can.
That's where in the tale they saw the witches holding their whatever they were doing with the woman's breast.
Yeah, doing their dodgy necromancy with cooking up their spells.
Yeah, can we just chat about what was going on in that ceremony? Because he was quite focused on the breast. There was a dead woman.
He obviously had time to take notes.
Yeah.
It's the fact that he was like, and I burst in there and I saved, I got the witch, but the rest of them flew away, but I got one of them.
Got one of them.
The dead woman.
Just mindlessly.
He was just at the window like, I wonder what's going on in there. Just peeking through the window.
Nicely lit though, so he could see it all.
Yeah, he could see that there was a skull in each corner of the room.
Yep.
Did he say how many women were there?
No, just a group of them. And then obviously you've got your nice witch's potion growing, being brewing up with.
Because that's what we all do on our Saturday nights.
I mean, because everything is very much like, by the time that was written, all those things are well established within the imagery of the Gothic witch story.
Yes, very stereotypical, like almost tropes of the genre, isn't it? And yeah, and I think Victorians as well like a good creepy tale. That's
yeah, they loved it
from the dim and distant, and they can just add a little bit of, oh well, that's what they thought back then to it, because there is an opening paragraph in Richardson which is a little bit was quite interesting, because it does talk about how even in the 1840s when they're writing it, there are still people in rural areas who do follow these practices against the fairy, but that it's preferable to think of these things as happening a long time ago in less enlightened times.
Yeah. There's a few Victorian accounts of the trials, which are quite interesting to look at, because they put their own spin on it. It's where we first see Matthew Bulmer being called a wizard, is in the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. There's no kind of mention of him being a wizard or a warlock prior to that. So they were putting their own kind of spin on things. We did actually see this handbook that Sylvia's talking about when we went to the archives.
Okay.
It was the weird little book that I was holding, and I was like, there's something important in this, but I can't find the page. I didn't have the page number, so I was just flicking through this book like, I know there's something in here, but I can't remember what it was. Yeah, you can see the Victorians very much were like, oh, look at those people back then. They were savages. They were brutal. They're just doing all these horrible things. Victorians weren't great either.
No, I like Victorians behaving badly, to be honest.
That sounds like a horrible histories episode.
Yeah, it probably is. But yeah, and I think one of the things the Victorians did as well was they collected so many of these oral traditions and folk tales, and then somehow that set them in stone, and a lot of them, well, I guess they were at a time when people were moving into industrial towns and not telling the tales as much. But it is funny that as soon as they got published, it's like everyone forgot the tale.
Yeah,
yeah.
It just seems to be like the 20th century, nobody was really talking about it or remembered it that much, other than just that nice alliterative Wall's End witches phrase.
Yeah.
Where is the Holy Cross Church then?
It's, it depends if you know Wall's End. So there's Hall Grounds, I think I wrote some directions. Yeah, so it's, you can approach it, there's a housing estate just off the coast road where you can go in a nice sort of straightforward way. But the best way is through Old Hall Grounds Park. So it's all nice trees. You follow the river through the park. You go to there's a burn opens out from the park. So you follow along the burn. And then there's like old trees and a scrubby hill with some little narrow steps that you can go up. And it's very atmospheric. So you kind of creep up these steps. And then the hill is, there's a sort of hill and the church is at the top of the hill. And that's the nicest way to do it. And definitely imagine doing that on a dark night.
And this is, again, sorry, this is a stupid question. The hill have been there when Delaval's telling the story.
Oh, yeah, the church is medieval.
Yeah, so he would have had to have crept up these. What was he doing? What was he doing creeping around the church at night?
Going for a walk, man.
He's supposed to be coming back from Newcastle to Seaton Delaval, but that seems like a really long way.
That is a bit of a diversion.
Just popped in up this church, yeah.
Maybe he was a little bit drunk, or maybe on something else.
I think there's probably a hint of snuff in there. You know? I mean, not actually, that probably sounds really wrong. I meant like the powdered snuff.
Yeah. So there's just so much about that ceremony that is just kind of odd, isn't there? It's one, it's very detailed, which the more people tend to tell
great
stories.
It's a spooky story, though.
Yeah.
It is a good spooky story.
And I guess it's like necromancy, isn't it? Bringing up the dead to, you know, perform rituals. And I mean, the Agnes Sampson said she'd attached parts of corpses to a cat, so to then try and kill the king.
It's also just the fact that they had four random skulls there, and it was like no one noticed that four people just kind of...
It's a graveyard.
Maybe were killed? Oh, it's a graveyard.
It's a graveyard. It's a church. It's got a graveyard around it.
Ready access to
corpses. Yeah, they have bits of coffins to feed the fire.
I sounded far too excited about the fact it was a graveyard.
Lots of ready-made dead people.
Yeah, so they can use it in their weird necromancy ceremony.
Yeah, and it's a lovely graveyard. I mean, they have lots of 18th, I think they might even have some 17th century stones there, which are quite unusual. But lots of 18th century stones, very worn now, and they've got all of the, you know, as I am now, so you shall be.
Yeah.
Creepy epithets on them. But yeah, I don't think in the past they buried bodies as deep as they do now, so there probably would be bits poking up every now and then.
Oh, wonderful.
Nice and easy.
It's strange how like our desire to have like logic in everything is sort of ruining the poetry of the Walls End Witches.
Of this lovely tale. Yeah. Where did they get the skulls from? But then also, what is this man's obsession with
spoken
the breast?
Like a true like film producer, like where can I access these skulls?
But yeah, and I think the obsession with the breast definitely comes from the Victorians.
Yeah.
The Victorians writing it, that was probably as saucy as they could get.
It's the fact they mentioned it when it was it chucked into the cauldron?
Yeah, I think he mentioned it about 3 times.
Yeah, when you said cauldron or kettle, I know what you meant, but I generally immediately thought of like an electric kettle.
Yeah.
And just this man just throwing things into an electric kettle.
This is the new story with the Roombas and the electric kettle.
If I was telling the story in the pub, it would be an electric kettle, but...
I think that would work. Yeah.
But it's something that we'd spoken to Tabitha about in the magic episode, was this idea of people flying around in sieves, and like witches were kind of very closely associated with household appliances and almost like the woman's role.
Yeah, it's like rejecting the domestic.
It's subversion, isn't it? Yeah. And also, I mean, I guess as well, because that's what would have been available to people, you know, they're not ritual high magicians with access to lots of elaborate equipment. The people being accused are like just little local women with limited utensils to do magic with.
Yeah. So it would be like a cauldron or something that would resemble like a big...
Yeah, just
a big metal bowl.
Cooking pot, yeah. Or a kettle, which I'm guessing is probably similar to an old-fashioned normal kettle.
Yeah. And then the other strange part of the tale is obviously the fact that apparently this witch was... this accused witch was burnt at the stake. In Northumberland?
Yeah, and that's like, there's no evidence, there's nothing in the records to say that anybody accused of witchcraft was burned on the beaches in Northumberland. That, because there's somebody, I think there's a guy called Alan Fryer who'd looked into that side of it and he couldn't find anything. And I just think, short of it being mob rule, you know, you never know what went on under the radar of society and the law, but I don't think, I think that's purely imported from across the border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like something that they've kind of heard was going on and they've kind of stitched it in, because I think it's kind of more spooky or horrible to think of someone being burnt at the stake than someone almost being hung. Like the image in your head of like the kind of someone at a stake is quite different. So it's like that's more like for them, plucking that from Scotland and adding it to the tale, it's kind of adds more of a...
And I think as well, because... if that was added in later, say in the 18th century, if that element came in later, then that's also when that's a bit more separated from knowing that witches were routinely hanged in England. So, but yeah, I think as well, because Newcastle and Wall's End are access to shipping, you know, coal trade up and down. It probably wasn't that far up to North Berwick by boat. Tales would have passed along.
Yeah. Like, where this would have happened was right between where the North Berwick kind of trials happened, then obviously Newcastle, had its own tales.
And coal trade up and down the country. Yeah. So I'm sure the stories would have passed by, and especially because the North Berwick witches was like a treason trial, basically.
Yeah.
You know, trying to kill the king. So that everyone would have, I'm pretty sure everybody must have heard about that in some degree.
I would imagine that it was hard that people didn't know about it at the time period.
And obviously the Newcastle witches just down the road. The witch trials. So, yeah, I think there's been enough of talk about witches and real events happening for it to just stick to the tale of that real... As people who died off who knew the real Janet Pearson and her family, I'm pretty sure that the idea that was a real witch in Wall's End was just too good to miss to just add all of these extra accretions to the tale.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's an odd thing as well about beaches in Northumberland, because I remember when I was initially starting to research this, there were stories of accused witches being tied to stones and left for the sea to kind of wash them away. There's no evidence of that happening, but it's like a tale that kind of crops up every now and then.
I think they did that with the Covenanters in Scotland. Some of the Covenanters were tied to stakes and they're tied... I think that was the 1670s.
Yeah, there's tales of that happening... on the beach in Northumberland.
I know sometimes they did that with pirates in different parts of the world, didn't they? They would hang them at the high tide or something and let the in a gibbet and let
very
them drown.
Unhelpful comment that I'm about to make.
Oh, hello.
But I've seen this happen in Outlander.
Yes, oh my god, yes. Steve Bonnet.
I have not seen Outlander.
That is my
yeah.
But So the beach seems to have a bit of spooky kind of magic of its own with its own folklore, because it's not the first time I've heard of like a kind of folklore witch being killed at the beach.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a liminal place, isn't it? Between the land and the sea. Definitely a good place for magic and executing witches.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Going back to another part that we were talking about, she flew away on plates.
It's great.
I've been trying to reach, obviously, like, I'm sorry to do this to people, I've been trying to reach for, like, the logical bridge as to what plates could have maybe been mistaken for, and I don't know.
I don't think know if, like, they were just plates.
I feel like this entire thing probably is made up, so if you're making it up, why not fly away on plates?
Yeah, it's unexpected.
Yeah, that's for sure. Or if it was, like, an actual case where somebody managed to break free of the pyre and rush off and looked like they were running on something.
I think she was up in the sky.
She was totally up in the sky. On a plate.
Two plates,
Maria. A plate for each foot.
I worry about the second plate. I'm like, how did she synchronise them? Because it could have been really bad.
I mean, it didn't end well anyway. Yeah,
but
roller
skates. You've got to have them going at the same speed. You've got to, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of logistical worries about two plates. But yeah, I think it's I think it's part of the folklore.
Yeah, it's the two plates that she kind of flew away.
She did a spell on them.
Yeah, did it say, correct me if I'm wrong, did it say that the guy who brought her the plates had, like, washed them?
Yes.
And that's why the magic didn't work, because it wasn't her, it wasn't, like, the plate as it was, like, the dirty plate.
Yeah, she'd had two new plates, and she put a little spell on them and flew away, but the person who brought them over had dipped them in running water, and from the Janet Pearson tale, running water is good proof against the fairies and against, you know, you can break spells with it. So
I'm surprised she got on the air.
Yeah, no, actually it's quite good, yeah.
But yeah.
Maybe there's a logical problem there. So plot bunny.
Yeah, because one of the versions I'd heard of it was that she'd fell into the water and they'd pulled her out of the water.
Yeah.
She'd, like, I mean, she'd fell with her plates. She'd managed to get above the water, fell into the water, and they pulled her out.
I'm not sure she'd burn very well then. She'd be a bit wet.
That is a point, you know. We can poke holes in the story all
day. Somehow I think maybe it's not true. What just... do you think?
Yeah.
Just a smidge.
But the story of Janet is true.
Janet is definitely true.
Yes, you just don't know what actually happened to her.
No. And I think because it was brought up as an addition to the main case, that maybe she just got, I like to think she just got some penance and told, don't do that again. Or,
yeah, I think for the time period as well that she lived in, she probably didn't face as severe kind of punishment as they do later on.
Yeah, I think it'll be a warning, just don't do it again or else.
Yeah, because I think Joe Baff spoke as well, when they did accuse people of witchcraft, they used, like, you know, the bridle, the school's bridle and stuff like that. And there was, they did, like, just kind of fine people as well. So there were other punishments before kind of execution. So hopefully she wasn't executed and it was just a case of someone was trying to...
Yeah, I think they were out to get the family, but it might just be because the family were kind of awkward and annoying lots of people. But the records, the trial book that I was looking at, the depositions, there was a case in about 1586 of another person with another Janet Pearson, but spelt slightly differently, in Dunstan, which is, again, it's sort of on the Gateshead side, a few miles away. And there's nothing to say it was her, but it's kind of a nice thought that maybe she did get away. But then she was also in the court records again, so...
Yeah, so maybe she just kind of crossed over into the next town.
Yeah, I mean, it might not be her. It might be somebody completely different. It was sort of 16 years later, which is, I guess, quite a long time in 16th century for someone to...
To be fair, it seemed women seemed to get to a certain age because they seemed to have a problem with a lot of older women still kind of living. So it could be her. It
could be.
Especially because we know they didn't spell, people just kind of spelled things how they like to, kind of how I like to spell. They don't spell them how they should be. It was just kind of how they fancied, so.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I like to think she did get away and that maybe she made a life somewhere else that was away from litigious neighbours.
Yeah. Good on you, Janet. Good on you.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about the plates.
Yeah. that was the bit that got me when I first read the story. I was thinking, plates? One plate? Two plate? How is that working? But yeah, it's...
It's just... Obviously, like roller skates, that didn't exist back then, did they?
The 18th century. They were invented in the 18th century.
Ah, okay. A little Victorian kind of.
Yeah, I know a sad story about the man who invented them.
Oh.
He invented them. He was quite a show off. It was, he was called John Joseph Merlin. And he was.
Merlin?
John Joseph Merlin, yeah. He's connected with the Silver Swan at Bowes Museum. And he invented roller skates. And he was a famous violinist. And he used to dress as a barmaid, play the violin and roller skate. But he didn't invent brakes to the roller skates. So he entered this party dressed in his barmaid outfit, playing the violin and smashed into a huge mirror. And they were very upset about the mirror. He was okay, sort of. But they were very upset about the mirror. The report of the story just told you how much it cost to replace the mirror. He survived. But yeah, he was a bit eccentric.
Yeah, I was thinking like, I just don't know where you'd get the idea from of someone flying away on two plates. It's just such a very specific image. It's a very, like, standout image in my head.
Well, it's shocking, isn't it? And I guess if you're telling that kind of tale, you're just telling it to shock people.
Yeah, and also...
And then if that isn't bad enough, she flew away on plates.
Plates? Yeah,
plates.
You can imagine, like, a group of men in the pub, though, can't you? Just sitting there going, just adding. And he's, like, he's just sitting there waiting to see, like, everyone's reactions. And he's like, guess what? What was next? No. What's next? She flew away off the pyre. Like, oh, and they're plates. Just all like,
on plates.
On plates. But the man remembered to wash them in running water. Like, you can imagine them all in the pub drinking as they're telling this story.
Yeah, it's plates.
On that note.
Yeah, that's... That's the tale of the Walls End Witches and of Janet.
It certainly is.
I like to think Janet got away, especially if there's no kind of record of her kind of execution. I like to think she just kind of was like, this is getting a bit awkward. I'm going to do the thing and then I'm going to go over there.
Yeah.
Hopefully she just went off to Gateshead.
Yeah.
Good on you, Janet. Good on you.
Yeah.
Because she seemed like, you know, she was doing things to help people. She wasn't being
She seemed like she had trade.
Yeah.
From what you've told us. Absolutely. She had work. She could just go elsewhere with the work.
Yeah. So, fingers crossed for Janet.
Yeah. Let's hope this is a case of that. She did get away and this was just a kind of embellished story.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Very theatrical people decided
Definitely.
They were going to add.
Thank you for letting me talk about Walls End Witches.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you for coming. You have to come back and regale us with more tales.
Yeah, your blog was one of the first things I found when I was looking at the Newcastle Witches. And I remember reading it at the time, but obviously all your blog posts are kind of from like around that topic, from like 2013 to maybe about 2016.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wonder if she's still active.
Oh, yeah.
That's when I reached. I just kind of had your like link sitting, and I was like, I'm gonna go have a look and see if she's still active and doing. And lo and behold, you were.
Oh yes, I think the last one was on the Charles Smith Human Skin book from Central Library.
That's something for another time, definitely. I bought a human skin book. Okay, that's very hocus pocus as well.
Oh yeah, it's quite interesting picking up. Well, the binding isn't human, bit of human skin inside it, but still creepy.
Yeah, definitely.
Very sad story.
Yes, thank you for joining us for our special Halloween episode. We decided for Halloween to kind of, obviously the podcast is quite serious. We decided to tell a story that was kind of important to the area, but also that we kind of know was more or less fiction and something that was just kind of fun for Halloween rather than something incredibly serious. So we hoped you enjoyed this small break and this tale of the Walls End Witches. Thank you for joining us, Sylvia.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we'll see you all in the next episode.
Bye-bye.